A protest sign from the police shooting of an unarmed black man read, "They can't kill us all."
That sign, "They can't kill us all," captured so much of it. You know, that people are in the streets with their physical bodies saying, you know, one, there are a lot of us, they can't kill all of us. But second, that we can't let them kill us all. That this was this urgency that was captured in the moment of these demonstrations. And so that was the urgency is what I hope to get across in the book. And so therefore, I just thought that the title, that sign, as we were thinking about what the title of the book, that sign was just the thing we settled on and I thought was fitting.
That's journalist Wesley Lowery. We talk with him about his acclaimed book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Then Betsy DeVos is up for confirmation as Secretary of Education. Opponents have made much of her conflicts of interest and hostility to public schools, but few have noted an other disturbing fact.
We're no longer talking about just the secular private school options. We're talking about direct funding of religious education. In the case of Betsy DeVos, she takes that same idea, and that is that the public schools are the enemy. And that she's told a private gathering a few years ago that her work in education is intended to advance God's agenda.
That's Frederick Clarkson of Political Research Associates. We talk with him about Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration's theocratic vision for America. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. We're also on PRX. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. On August 19th, 2014, unarmed teenager Michael Brown was gunned down in Ferguson, Missouri, by white police officer Darren Wilson. When reporter Wesley Lowery was sent by the Washington Post to cover the unrest that ensued, the last thing he expected was to become part of the story. But that's what happened when he was forcibly arrested at a McDonald's, where he'd been peacefully eating and writing a story for the day. Lowery's experience as a young black man in America, as well as his talent as a writer, make his book, They Can't Kill Us All, an invaluable contribution to our understanding of the roots and development of the Black Lives Matter movement. As much a discourse on the role and record of the media in reporting that movement as on the movement itself, They Can't Kill Us All moves from the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson to the murder of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland and then the murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore to show us in vivid prose what Black Lives Matter means for America and why it's so important. Wesley Lowery is a national reporter for The Washington Post, covering law enforcement, justice, race, and politics. In 2014, he was named the National Association of Black Journalists Emerging Journalist of the Year and was on the team that won the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for reporting on police shootings. Well, I want to thank you, Wesley Lowery, for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
They Can't Kill Us All. Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America, in America's racial justice movement. They Can't Kill Us All. It's in quotes. Where did that quote come from?
Well, the quote comes from a sign that was left at a protest in St. Louis after the death of Antonio Martin. Now, Antonio Martin was a young black man who was killed not long after Michael Brown and not long after the grand jury decision not to charge the officer who killed him. Darren Wilson. Now, in this shooting, this is what the police would call, you know, a quote-unquote good shooting, a good kill. This was a young man armed with a gun who had pointed it at an officer. But the police and the local officials were still shocked when there were still protests. There were demonstrations. People were upset. People were demanding answers and explanations. And they said, look, but these are the type of people we're supposed to kill. And I remember there was a sign left near the foot of Antonio Martin's killed near a gas station, something at the foot of one of the signposts, and it said, you know, they can't kill us all. When I set out to write this book, I had a few different goals or, you know, kind of things I was hoping to accomplish with it. One was, you know, I wanted to tell kind of a first-person story of what it was like to cover the protest movement. Two, I wanted to tell the individual stories of many activists. If you read the book, it's a lot of individual vignettes of Doreen McKesson or Bree Newsome or Brittany Packnett, Clifton Kinney, various people who become figures. But I also wanted to capture the ethos and the ideology of the broad protest movement. Now, here you had this decentralized effort that thrust tens of thousands of people into the street across various American cities. What were they trying to say? What was the message they wanted to send? And I think that sign, "They Can't Kill Us All," captured so much of it. You know, that people are in the streets with their physical bodies saying, you know, one, there are a lot of us, they can't kill all of us, but second, that we can't let them kill us all. That this was this urgency that was captured in the moment of these demonstrations. And so that was the urgency is what I hope to get across in the book. And so therefore, I just thought that title, that sign, as we were thinking about what the title of the book, that sign was just the thing we settled on and I thought was fitting.
So Donald Trump, the other day in his inauguration speech, referred to carnage in America, but I don't think he was talking about the kind of carnage that you and your colleagues at the Washington Post actually compiled into a national shootings database on the killing of unarmed black people. What did you find?
So what we found is we set out to answer this question of how many people have been killed, are being killed by the police, being shot by the police. Now, in Ferguson, I was one of our lead reporters on the ground in Ferguson, and I would write these stories where activists or residents, people who are in the streets, people concerned with civil rights would say things like, every day, you know, unarmed black men are being gunned down in the streets, are being executed in the streets. And when we would go, since we were reporters, we would call the police, we would call the police unions, and they would say, no, that's not true. We barely ever kill anybody. And when we do, it's definitely never unarmed black people. And by the way, everyone we kill, they totally deserved it. They had it coming. And so I would write these stories. One side would say one thing, the other side would say another thing. And because I had smart editors at the Washington Post, they would say, well, but wait a second. Both those things can't be true. Either the police are killing unarmed black people every single day and executing them in the streets, or the police shootings are rare and never happen. Which one is true? And so because we were, you know, reporters, we started digging around. Who knows? Did the Secretary of State for Missouri have these numbers? Did the DOJ have these numbers? And what we found out essentially was that the only even close to accurate counts were a bunch of kind of crowdsourced accounts, killedbypolice.net and a true crime author living outside of Las Vegas who was keeping these statistics himself. You know, there was no actual, comprehensive account. The feds weren't keeping this information and others weren't. And so we said, you know, look, we need to know, the public should have the right to know how many people are being killed and under what circumstances. Because if we think if tens of thousands of people in the streets are telling us that this is happening too often, how would anyone be able to cut down on how often it's happening if we don't even know how often it's happening? And so what we started doing is we built a database. It's now in its third year, where we every day scour the internet and find any account of a fatal officer-involved shooting. And as that happens, we record those, and then we go back and we confirm the information. We do a bunch of original reporting. You know, and so what we've done is we initially, in the first year, we found more than double the number of fatal shootings that the FBI numbers said were happening. And so we proved how poor the federal data was on this. But we also found a lot of interesting things. You know, a quarter of people who are shot and killed by the police are in the midst of some mental health crisis, that there are dozens of officers every year who will kill someone, and it's not the first person they've killed. In fact, it's the second or third. You know, and so we focused on body cameras is a big thing that people have talked about. But what we found is that the majority of shootings, even when it's caught on a body camera, the public never gets to see the video. And so the point was that, you know, the police are a powerful form of government. They're, for many Americans, the most powerful and direct link they will ever have to their government. And so there needs to be some scrutiny and there needs to be some questions asked in order to, you know, attain a level of accountability for these powerful people who are in our streets.
So what did you find, actually? What kinds of statistics did you find? And what did you find about unarmed people in general versus unarmed black people being shot and killed?
So the vast majority of people who are killed by the police, so there are about 1,000 people shot and killed by the police every year, more than 1,000 when you start adding in people who have been tased and die or beaten and die or something like that, right? But about just under 1,000 people a year are shot and killed by the police, the vast majority of whom are armed. But a much smaller section of them are unarmed. Now, in general, Right, in raw numbers, the vast majority of people killed by the police are also white. Now, the vast majority of Americans are white as well. There are tens of millions more white people than there are black and brown people in the United States of America. So it's unsurprising that in raw numbers. But when you start breaking it down by percentages, what we see is we see a deep overrepresentation, both in terms of the number of black people who are killed by police in general, and then also the number of black people who are unarmed when they are killed by the police. And that starts to speak to these disparities that were being seen and what people were talking about during some of these demonstrations, that a unarmed black man is somewhere between 2.5 to 3.5 times more likely to be shot and killed than an unarmed white man. It's where we start seeing, all right, perhaps is there some level of racial bias or discrepancy here, because it does not make sense that, you know, a group of people who make up just 12% of the population, black people, and black men are 6% of the population, that they would be making up 24% of the unarmed people killed.
So now the first third of this terrific book, They Can't Kill Us All, Wesley Lowery, is taken up with Ferguson, and you became part of the story yourself. I mean, I was one of the millions of people who saw you getting arrested in the McDonald's, was it?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about what that was like for you as a reporter to become part of the story.
Well, very frustrating. I mean, one of the things about when you are thrust into a story this way is that you become a political football to be kicked around. I remember there was, you know, talking heads are getting mad at us. You know, we must have done this on purpose to get ourselves arrested. There were these kind of far-right blogs writing about, one of them wrote that myself and Ryan Riley, who I was arrested with, he's a Huffington Post reporter, that we were an example of the failure of the American father or something, and we were going to make terrible fathers because we didn't, you know, because the police arrested us, something like that, right? We became these targets to be attacked, which is a very uncomfortable position for a reporter to be in. You know, we're very used to asking the questions, but I think that, you know, all of a sudden we were people who were asking questions about. They were interviewing us. They wanted us to come on TV. They want to do all these things. And I mean, that can become very uncomfortable. Now, one thing is that it did, in Ferguson itself, help provide, to some extent, additional credibility, in that many of the people there, while they deeply distrusted the police, also deeply distrusted the media. But now here we were, these young people who the people of Ferguson had watched be mistreated by their police officers, and they would come up to us in the streets and say, "Hey, you're that guy from the McDonald's video. Hey, let me tell you my story. Let me talk to you about the time." And so all of a sudden we had this deep access to so many people on the ground, and I just think that was a very interesting experience. You know, it gave both myself and Ryan much more prominence than we had previously. I mean, we were both working at big national papers, so it's not like we, you know, had no platform or no prominence, but it also drew a lot of extra attention to the work we were doing, which I think did really help in terms of getting our reporting out there and getting our coverage and having it seen by other people.
Yeah, this book is as much about reporting the story as the story itself. You say that you got a lot more credibility basically on the street because of that. What are your thoughts on how the media in general is treated, why there's distrust of the media? Do you think that the media has some part to play in that story? And if so, what are also some of the other parts that the media may not be so responsible for? What are some other factors in that distrust?
I mean, look, I think that we have a lot of factors. First of all, the media is a institution. The media has a lot of its own problems with diversity, with giving fair and honest coverage to people of color, and it always has. You know, the media has been a large part of the problem historically as it relates to black and brown communities and black and brown people. We sensationalize the stories of black and brown crime. We run mugshots constantly. We focus on death and destruction and dysfunction. We often traffic in racial stereotypes and tropes. I mean, and historically, that's just always been the case, and that remains the case. Now, and so I think that we need to understand that coming in. I mean, the other thing is, very often there's a sense of entitlement in the media. We're showing up in your community. because someone's been killed or something's happened, and we cannot fathom why you won't give us interviews or pictures, and why won't you provide us information? Don't you know that the only way anything good is ever going to happen for you is that if you give us all of your personal information and tell us all the things we want to know, even though we're never going to show up here again after that? I think that that sense of entitlement, people remember that. I can remember being a Metro reporter in Boston and L.A. and showing up at communities that maybe someone hadn't been in for a little while from the media, and people were still very upset about that thing that the paper I worked for did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, 40 years ago, before I was even born, right? And so I think that sometimes the biggest step, the biggest thing we need to do is be aware and cognizant of the fact that we're not deeply trusted in many spaces, and that we have to earn that trust. We have to build those relationships. I think that that's something that is I think that's something that's extremely important. I think that in the case when we talk about policing and things like that, I think often we also very historically have given deep credibility and trusted the word of the police, and we've been deeply the word on the streets. And I think that that is something that has not ingratiated us to Black and brown communities, that we very often are the mouthpieces through which police departments falsehoods. I think, and we are not always aggressive enough in how we push back or the accountability we require. I think that's something that's really important as well, is being willing to hold everyone to account, and also being willing to hold to a higher account the government officials, right? When a police officer shoots and kills a teenager in the streets, the burden of proof is not on the dead teenager. It's on the taxpayer-funded agent of the state who's killed a teenager, right? And I think that we as the media have to remember that. It's not our job to be cozy with power. Rather, it's our job to ask hard questions of power.
Yeah, I agree with that. On the other hand, we are seeing an almost unprecedented attack on the press from our newly elected national leaders. And you were arrested, and it seems that more and more journalists are being arrested. In fact, journalists were arrested at the inaugural at Trump's inauguration the other day, and they're being charged with felonies. So I wonder if you could also talk about how distrust in the media is also being sown, and how, what do you think needs to be done?
You know, I think that, I don't know that, you know, I think it's a complicated question. I agree that there is an unprecedented level of attack on the media, or at least not recently precedented. You know, I'm sure Richard Nixon, if we lined all his statements up, wasn't saying a lot of fun things about the press, right? I'm sure there was at least one founder, one early president who hated the press and said a bunch of things like this as well, right? And so I think sometimes I think that's a problem we have. I think in the media very often we very quickly default to calling anything that seems new to us unprecedented, and I just don't know the history of that. But with that said, and I do think we have to remember that it is also not our job to be liked by the people we cover or by the people who receive our coverage, right? It's our job to tell the truth. And sometimes that truth is going to make us unpopular with people, and it's going to frustrate people. Now, that said, I do think that we do have a credibility issue and a credibility gap right now. But I think that what's important there is two things. One, we have to get things right, which means we have to slow down. I think that this is in part symptomatic of the speed with which both the internet and the 24-hour news cycle has forced the media to operate in. But I also think that, and it's because of that, we are confirming fewer things independently ourselves, and rather we are relying on the reporting of other people very often, and I think that is where we can mess up. One bad report from one place all of a sudden has rocketed across the internet with massive speed. But I also think we need to be willing to tell stories that have nothing to do with the presidency sometimes. You know, I think that what I want is, I want to think about, you know, that Trump voter who doesn't distrust the media, who's convinced that everything we write about Donald Trump is a political smear and an attack or, you know, X, Y, and Z. How do we make sure that we are still doing journalism if they don't believe anything we write about Trump? How are we still doing journalism that makes that person's life better every day? How do we take down the local dog catcher who's secretly stealing from the city funds? How do we take down the priest who is molesting children? Right? How do we make sure that our journalism, while we are certainly facing and we are certainly in a time of uncertainty and where we need a lot of reporting at the federal government level, we also cannot allow that to keep us from doing the meat and potatoes work that we do every single day to make people's lives better.
One thing that you've been actually helped in doing that, and you talk about in this book, They Can't Kill Us All, Wesley Lowery, you talk about the role of social media in the development of the Black Lives Matter movement, the racial justice movement more in general, as we can say. Talk about citizen journalism and NETA, one of the protest movement's chief correspondents in Ferguson.
So what is fascinating, and I think one of the reasons that we had, you know, people ask why now, why did Black Lives Matter, why did police shootings, why did this surface in this moment, right? And I think because it's something that's certainly not new, has been happening before, that has always been going on. But I think one of the reasons now is that Black and Brown Americans had a unique moment and unique access to the ability to tell their own stories. I think this gets back to the idea that the media has not always done a particularly good job of covering these stories, of being in places. I don't know what the last time the St. Louis media had covered Ferguson, Missouri, prior to Michael Brown's death. Perhaps they hadn't shown up in a year or two, right? We don't always tell these stories very well, but now with both the dissemination of smartphones across the country to people of different socioeconomic statuses, as well as social media, people are able to tell their own stories. It democratizes the news to an extent where if the content is compelling, it can catch fire even if not a single news organization covers it. I think that is very different than what it was previously. Previously, if I wanted you to cover this thing that happened in my neighborhood, maybe I could call the reporter, I could send a letter to the editor, but it was completely up to the subjective decision of the members of the media of whether or not they would cover these stories, and that created space for their own biases to seep into what is covered and what is not covered. I think that is a very, I think that is what has changed, is that there is now no barrier to entry to information, that I can sit in my home and I can send a series of tweets that can be seen by the entire world. I can start a Facebook live stream that can be seen by the entire world. I talked to Janetta Eldy. She's one of the first people I profile, and she's one of the first people I profile, and she is a what they call a kind of quote day one protester. She was out there from the first day, seeing Michael Brown's body, and being shocked by what she'd seen. Now, NETA, one of the last police shootings in St. Louis prior to Michael Brown's death, was of her friend, Stefan Avery Hart. And so she had recently personally gone through this before. And so she's sitting at home watching this coverage, and she says, you know what, I watched how my friend, when he was killed, he got villainized by the media, people called him all these names, she read all the comments online. She says, this isn't happening to this kid, this isn't happening to Mike. And so she goes outside, and she starts documenting everything. She's taking pictures of the police, she's taking pictures of the tear gas, of the dogs, the blood streak from the body. And so she starts essentially sending these dispatches from the ground. She became, in many ways, the first citizen journalist there. And it was just remarkable how she was able, without the filter of media, to be a voice from the ground. I think that's we've seen that now in a way that we just were not able to see previously.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Washington Post journalist Wesley Lowery about his book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Talk a little bit more about the narrative of the killings of unarmed Black people. I mean, I think, you know, when Michael Brown was shot, you know, people blamed him. I mean, you know, he had strong-armed somebody, and it looked like, in a convenience store that he went into, and so automatically people just dismissed him. Could you talk about the larger context of the narrative about Black people in this country and how that feeds into the narrative about the killing of Black people?
Well, of course. I mean, I think that, and again, this goes back to something I said earlier, where I think very often our inclination, because we are a nation that where most people deeply trust the police, we're very patriotic, we're very law and order oriented, we do not want to, we don't like the idea of unrest. We don't like the idea of questioning authority. We don't like it when people don't listen to what a cop says, right? That's what the Americans broadly, and especially white Americans. And so we have this inclination almost immediately to question and interrogate the dead child and their dead 18-year-old. And never, or not to the same extent, interrogate the adult who shot and killed him, right? Again, with our money that we paid for in our name and to protect the public, right? Now, but the other thing is, I think this mistake the media makes. We arrive in a Ferguson and we only want to focus on the hyper-specifics of what happened to Michael Brown. We arrive in a Baltimore and we only want to focus on the hyper-specifics of what happened to Freddie Gray. The reality is, in the real world, there are no isolated incidents. That everything is connected together. That if seven things happen in my neighborhood, they all make up my impression in the world in which I see you know, my impression of police, my impression of government. And so in Ferguson, Missouri, for example, a place where where fines and fees or arrests were being used remarkably aggressively as a means almost of a tax on the poor black populace of the city, the death of Michael Brown was just a line in the sand. It was that many of the people who were out in the streets because of the way they had been treated a few months earlier. They were out in the streets because of, you know, the way their mother or their father or their brother had been treated. That this wasn't just about this shooting or this incident, but rather it's about something else. And this goes to the reality of what it's like to be a black person in America and to interact with the police. And I think that something I can understand as a black man in America, whether I'm a reporter or not, is that for much of white America, the police are protectors, they're friends, they're people you eagerly call. Most black people I know are not trying to ever call the police under any circumstance, right? That an interaction with the police officer could very quickly ruin your life. I think that there's a, very often our politicians talk about us needing to restore trust, or rebuild the trust between the black community and police. But I think that fundamentally misses the point. You cannot rebuild, you cannot restore that which never existed. There's never been trust between black communities and police officers. In fact, because our modern police in the United States of America began with slave patrols and slave catchers. The idea that somehow there has ever been trust between and black people, when police, in fact, were very often served in a functionality of containing and controlling black populaces and enforcing racist policies, whether that be redlining, whether that be Jim Crow, whether that be segregation, it really begins the conversation at the wrong point. We don't need to restore trust. We need to create a trust that never existed. And when we set out to create a trust that never existed, that perhaps means we need to do different things than, quote-unquote, restoring trust. And so I think that's just something that we have to remember when we talk about this. We have to understand and remember the historical context.
Yeah. So, you know, when Barack Obama was elected president, there were a lot of people who said that, well, now we live in a post-racial America. I think since the campaign, a lot of those voices have gotten a lot more silent. But I read a recent op-ed in the New York Times by Ibram X. Kendi that said that while there has been progress on race in America, there's also been the progress of racism. And it almost seems like there is a dialectic between them. There's progress on race, and then there's the backlash on race, on that progress. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's unquestionably true, and history tells us that, right? We see that in Reconstruction. We see that in the 60s in response to the Civil Rights Movement. We see that now in response to the election of a black president, as well as a new era in the racial justice movement focused on policing. That we see that the white majority feels threatened. They feel as if it is a seesaw, that if things improve for the black minority, things must have to get worse for them, and they lash out in response to that, right? We see this time and time again. And so it's unsurprising to me that people are theorizing this, and it's also unsurprising to me that we are seeing this. And I think we are clearly seeing this. You know, we just elected as president someone who, in many ways, premised parts of his campaign on clear racism and nativism and misogyny, right? The idea that you look at the primary policy proposals, whether you agree with them or not, and they are premised in the fear of the other, right? They're premised in the idea of the scary immigrants coming to kill you and scary ISIS coming to kill you and the rapists from Mexico coming over across the border and the scary black people in the inner cities, you know, in whatever words he uses to describe them, right? All of these things are very base level. I mean, this is race baiting 101. I think that's kind of the, and dog whistling 101. I think that is unsurprising to me that a white populace that has felt disenfranchised for 8 years has felt as if this other, this Barack Obama, has come and threatens, you know, democracy. And then meanwhile, they're seeing things like black youth in the streets demanding equity. That's scary to a lot of white Americans. And it's unsurprising to me that we have now seen several things happen in the public, including the election of Donald Trump, that seem to suggest that type of white lash.
And you mentioned, you know, that they see people in the black people in the streets demanding equity. You know, one of the things that I hadn't really thought about before was the issue of violence and riots in the street versus protest in the street. You write in this book, Wesley Lowery, you write in They Can't Kill Us All, that organized protest almost never results in violence, and that the riots we see are really spontaneous. I wonder if you could draw out that distinction.
Well, of course, and I think there's a distinction, and that's not to underplay the reality that there are many times riots or physical violent unrest. That does happen, and I don't think we should not acknowledge it, because I think that raises a question, right? I think that in response to a violent unrest, people can respond one of two ways. Either we can say, what is wrong with those people, which starts to raise some real questions about what you're saying about who these fellow Americans of ours, who they are, or we can say, how have these people been treated that they feel that this is their only option, that they feel so hopeless, so back into a corner, so disconnected from the social contract of American life, that this is how they need to respond or how they feel as they should respond? I think that should be the question. Now, again, what's fascinating in many of these cities, whether it be Baltimore, whether it be Ferguson, or Cleveland, or Milwaukee, is that, yes, the violence is often deeply spontaneous. It's often a release valve of frustration and anger that has been building for years, sometimes decades and generations. But in most cases, the people who show up in the streets on day two, day three, day four, under organized banners or the organized chants, are completely peaceful. We've not seen much response in terms of an actual, you know, violent response to these things. Rather, most people who are organizing and who are protesting are doing so with the idea of, you know, kind of peacefully petitioning their government.
Yeah, and I also think there's an incredible contrast. You know, if you contrast what happened, the violent takeover of public lands in Montana that happened a year or over a year ago, with acquittals of everyone who had done that, a complete hands-off policy by the federal government and local law enforcement, versus the overweening militarization of the response in places like Ferguson.
Well, the idea that you know, a few dozen black or brown people could seize a federal park with guns and you know, for days, I think that went on for a month or something, right? There's no way. Like five black people couldn't seize a park in downtown Milwaukee for 2 hours without the cops coming and something happening. And so I do think it speaks to kind of how we view different types of protests, some that are legitimate, some that are not.
Yeah. Well, let's move forward here. Black Lives Matter, I wonder if you could talk about, the rise of this movement, because it was more than Ferguson. What's your take on it now in the era of Trump? Is it going to be suppressed? Is it going to actually grow larger because of the challenge?
Well, it's hard to tell. It's hard to predict what's going to happen in the board. Now, I know that many of the activists and the groups have decided are going to dig in their heels. I think we're going to see a lot of activism that is related not just to Black life, but also broadly to other kind of allied causes, whether that be immigration, whether that be Muslims. You know, I think there are going to be various cases, women's access to contraceptions, LGBTQ issues. I think there's going to be a coalition kind of to the center left that seeks and strives to very aggressively combat the promise of action from the Trump administration in these spaces. But I think that, you know, when we look at the movement for Black Lives, I think that we need to look at it in waves to understand it. Right? Again, there's no isolated incident. There's no one thing. There's no one birth. Right? If you begin, my argument would be that this is a movement that is born uniquely of the Obama years, and only could have been born of the Obama years, and that really starts with Oscar Grant, who was killed 19 days before the inauguration of President Obama, and so he is killed on New Year's Day, or late New Year's Eve in 2009, in Oakland. We see that first wave of deaths, right? Oscar Grant is killed, but most people, you know, that happens, but it gets lost in all the coverage of the presidency. But by the time the movie Fruitvale Station is made about Oscar Grant's death, it comes out in about 2012, 2013, you've got the deaths of the execution of Troy Davis in Georgia. You've got the deaths of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis, both by vigilantes, and that's about in 2012. By 2014, you've had the deaths of Eric Garner, John Crawford, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and so that is kind of the second wave to me. In 2015, you've got Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Sam DuBose, and then in 2016, you've got the deaths of Philando Castillo, Alton Sterling, Keith Lamont Scott, Seville Smith in Milwaukee. And so again, what I look at it is I look at it in four distinct waves that make up kind of the movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter. And I think that's kind of how I look at it and how I think about it. What happens next? What is the next wave? It's hard to tell, but I think that's something that I'm really interested and fascinated to see what happens.
Yeah, it almost reminds me, or at least when I'm being hopeful, of the theory that revolutions come with rising expectations. It seems that there was real progress made in that, perhaps very overused word, the conversation about race in America that happened as a result of Black Lives Matter and continues to happen. And once you achieve something, can you really go all the way back?
Exactly. Well, I think it's interesting, and I definitely think you can. For the record, I mean, again, I think Reconstruction tells us that we had a world in which we had dozens of Black lawmakers elected, millions of Black residents registered to vote, and then we watched Jim Crow laws completely decimate that, right? And so I think that what thing we have to remember as Americans is that we are not any greater than our history, and that we have to know our history and remember our history, because if we don't, we certainly can return to where we were previously.
And so finally, you finish this book, They Can't Kill Us All. It's been widely acclaimed. What do you feel is important for readers to take away with them?
Oh, again, I think that whether you agree with the ideals of the movement for Black Lives or not, what I think is important is that readers understand the legitimacy of the feelings of the demonstrators and of the protesters, right? That they understand and they grasp that this is real pain being felt by Black Americans. Whether you agree with this pain or not is in many ways irrelevant, because it does exist. And these are people who we live with and who we cohabitate this nation with, right? I think sometimes our empathy gap is one of the biggest things that prevents us from properly hearing each other and then properly solving problems that we all face. And so the hope through telling the stories of any of these young activists and any of these young demonstrators is that perhaps it can provide a better understanding of their motivations, of their fears, of their desires for people who otherwise might not understand.
Well, it's a terrific book, They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. I want to thank you so much, Wesley Lowery, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
Wesley Lowery. You can see the video of his arrest in Ferguson by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Fred Clarkson warns us about the Trump administration's theocratic vision for America. Stay tuned after the break.
I feel the violence in my soul. I feel the violence in my soul. Tired of human lives turned into hashtags and prayer hands. I'm tired of watching these murderers get off while we bury the lost in love. Innocent brothers and sisters, it's time to wake up, wake up, wake up. Brothers and sisters, it's time to say something, do something, make them. I wonder how many black lives, how many black lives, how many heartbeats turned into flat lines, oh. How many black lives, how many black lives does it take to wake a change? Does it take to wake a change? Does it take to wake a change? We can't let them die in vain. Will it take to wake a change?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On January 31st, confirmation hearings for Betsy DeVos, Trump's pick for education secretary, made it out of a Senate committee for a hearing before the full Senate. Her moral fitness for office has been sharply questioned as a result of serious conflicts of interest and reports she'd plagiarized part of her questionnaire to the Senate. But little mention has been made of her extreme religious views on education, views that could translate into policy that erodes our constitutional wall between religion and state. My guest, Frederick Clarkson, has been studying right-wing Christian extremism for many years, and he's spoken about it before on Writer's Voice more than a decade ago. He's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates, a think tank that studies right-wing movements in America. He co-founded the blog Talk to Action and authored the book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Well, Frederick Clarkson, welcome back to Writer's Voice. It's been years, really, and I'm so glad to have you back.
Great to be back.
So you are the author of the recent article, which is now in the Public Eye magazine, the winter issue, A Dystrumpian Vision for LGBTQ People. But I'd like to actually ask him some questions that go beyond just LGBTQ, really talking about the whole issue of religious freedom for extreme right Christians and not for anybody else. Trump has just put a ban on people coming from Muslim countries. Religious freedom is a fundamental tenet, right, of the Constitution, as is the separation of church and state. I wonder if you could talk about these issues in the context of Trump and his cabinet, and also his vice president.
Well, sure. The idea of religious supremacy and specifically Christian vision for most of Trump's cabinet is very clear, and we can talk about that in some detail. But on the question of religious tests, Article 6 of the Constitution says there'll be no religious test for public office, and the way that's been understood down through time by the federal courts and the Congress is anything to do with any of our functions as a society, our civil functions, don't get religious tests applied. You don't have any particular advantage or disadvantage based on your religious identity or lack thereof. So singling out Muslims in any way is a radical departure from a constitutional tradition that goes back to the beginning.
And what about separation of church and state? I mean, one of the things that I don't think a lot of people are aware of, because it hasn't really been talked about much in the media, is the right-wing evangelical agenda of Mike Pence, Betsy DeVos, you know, who is, you know, hearings are going on right now in Congress as whether to approve for her nomination as Secretary of Education. They've been centering around her her conflicts of interest, but not around her Christian evangelical agenda.
Yeah, that's true, and it's a great failure of our congressional leaders to not address this adequately. Mike Pence, you know, who heads the transition team as well as being vice president, when he was governor of Indiana, he continued and expanded a statewide school voucher program that diverted months funding from public schools to private religious schools via vouchers. So we're no longer talking about just secular private school options. We're talking about direct funding of religious education. In the case of Betsy DeVos, she takes that same idea, and that is that the public schools are the enemy. And that she's told a private gathering a few years ago that her work in education is intended to advance God's agenda. So the idea of privatization of the public schools in order to finance religious schools is completely consistent with Pence's thinking, and is a kind of approach that I think we'll see across a lot of programs throughout the federal government.
But if these are unconstitutional, how can they be challenged?
I think that people who disagree with these kinds of things need to go out and win some elections. I think it's kind of as simple as that. The certain things could be done in the courts, to be sure, and you can have street demonstrations, and that's fine. And people can raise their voices and write their op-eds and do all the usual things you do, but the great big elephant on the table, if you will, is that liberal left interest groups and the Democratic Party and moderate Republicans are failing at the ballot box. They're not developing electoral constituencies. They're not turning citizens into voters and voters into activists and activists into candidates in sufficient numbers with sufficient resources and a decent strategy to win. The Democrats have lost more seats in the state legislature than any party in American history, almost 1,000 seats since Obama took office. And while Obama was president, they lost both the House and the Senate as well. These are unprecedented losses that we should just not lose sight of that. We can do all the aforementioned things, but we must do this.
And, of course, we have to remember that the electoral landscape has been steeply tilted against Democrats recently. I mean, Hillary Clinton did win by 3 million votes, and Greg Palast, the investigative reporter for The Guardian, who we've spoken to, said that some 7 million voters were disenfranchised, largely Black, African-American, and Latino, who vote mostly Democratic. So that's an issue, too. But you say beyond that, we still need to strengthen our electoral strategies.
Well, that's right. The where voter disenfranchisement has happened because of playing around with voting machines or changing times and dates of electoral places. I mean, these happen primarily via state legislation. Mm-hmm. So, if you don't have fair-minded state legislators, you get the kind of voter suppression things that have happened in some states, like North Carolina. There's a difference between issue politics and electoral politics, and you don't win at the issues if you don't have the votes in the state legislatures. And in terms of the congressional redistricting kinds of questions that are coming up following the census every 10 years, there's complete congressional redistricting, and also redistricting for state legislative seats. Now, the Republicans did a fantastic job in gerrymandering districts to their advantage, and that's part of what's going on in terms of their electoral control, or rather their legislative control, in the states and in the Congress. So the Democrats and the liberal left have to get it together to take back a lot of those state legislative seats in time for the 2020 census, or it's only going to get worse.
And you're listening to Writer's Voice. We're talking with Frederick Clarkson of Political Research Associates about the Trump administration's theocratic vision for America. Now, to your article that is in the winter issue of the Public Eye magazine, A Distrumpian, I love that term, A Distrumpian Vision for LGBTQ People, talk about the attack on LGBTQ rights at a time where it really seemed as if those rights were assured.
Yeah, it's amazing, going back to where we began this conversation, that all of this attack on rights is being done under the rubric of religious freedom. And the religious freedom is defined by the Christian right, and they're in their attack mode, treats acceptance of gay and lesbian relationships in marriage and elsewhere as an affront to their own religious conscience. And we've seen this play out most famously in terms of businesses like bakeries who bake wedding cakes and florists who provide flowers for weddings who don't want to have to acknowledge or treat as equal same-sex marriages. But it's also playing out on a much wider scale. It's deeply concerning because I think these kinds of issues of public accommodation businesses will get resolved in the favor of gay couples. But it's the institutional exemptions that get really concerning, because even though the Civil Rights Act provides for very generous exemptions from all kinds of laws for religious institutions, the definition of religious institution, and therefore who gets covered under these kinds of exemptions, is expanding, thanks to recent Supreme Court decisions and different kinds of federal legislation. So the exemptions given to religious institutions can be extended to businesses, to colleges, to hospitals, and as this territory of exemption expands, the rights of LGBTQ people and others are going to be threatened because they'll have rights in some places and not in others, and it's going to get very tense and very complicated.
Do you see a connection between the threats to women's rights, such as reproductive rights, rights of access to abortion and contraception? Because I don't think a lot of people realize their rights of access to contraception are also being threatened. Do you see a connection between the threats to women's rights and the threats to LGBTQ rights?
Well, absolutely. People who are opposed to women's reproductive rights are usually also opposed to the rights of LGBTQ people, although it doesn't work quite that neatly. But these are both part of the Christian right agenda, objections to which are carried out under the rubric of religious freedom. But absolutely, it was the Hobby Lobby decision of the Supreme Court a few years ago that set the stage for allowing businesses to exempt themselves from provisions of the regulations of Obamacare that would require employers to provide a full range of contraceptive options in their health plans. So now that there is a legal exemption from the law for some contraceptions, there's now litigation to seek to expand that list. But most importantly, that decision declared the family-owned Hobby Lobby company to have religious rights under the law for the first time. A private business has religious freedom rights of conscience. So that principle has been extended elsewhere and is the basis for which the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in some of the states, most famously Indiana, that idea that third parties and businesses can have rights to discriminate in that way is rooted in the Hobby Lobby decision. So, there's a direct legal, judicial connection between those two areas of law.
And how come nobody challenged the constitutionality of that?
The constitutionality of Hobby Lobby?
Yeah, of the Hobby Lobby decision. I mean, if they're I thought discrimination was illegal under the Constitution, although I guess LGBTQ people are not part of that. Is that it?
Well, in the case of the Hobby Lobby case was about contraceptives and businesses having to include them in their health plan. So that was the Supreme Court that decided that. So obviously it's constitutional. It may come up again. But the provision in Hobby Lobby that has been taken out and reapplied in state legislative cases, there have been challenges there. And people may not remember, but when that legislation passed in Indiana that would have allowed businesses to discriminate, there was such a national outcry that the legislature had to specifically amend the legislation to say that it did not justify discrimination. So these kinds of things are going to keep coming up. There's a piece of federal legislation that's actually worse than anything we saw with state-level Religious Freedom Restoration Acts called the First Amendment Defense Act, FADA for short. And President Trump has said he will sign it if it reaches his desk, and there may be the votes in both houses of Congress to pass it. And that takes the idea that the kinds of discrimination we've just been talking about could be pretty universally applied, and that what's more, it wouldn't be simply a standard of an objection based on religious conscience or conscientious objection, as we sometimes say in other contexts, but rather also moral conscience. So one doesn't even have to be a part of a religious tradition or anything else. The phrasing moral conscience gives you a lot of wiggle room for just flat-out bigotry. So The First Amendment Defense Act would provide a very, very broad excuse, calling an exemption, but let's also call it an excuse to discriminate on any basis, stated or unstated, based on belief or no belief. I don't think we've ever seen anything like it in the history of the United States.
Well, Frederick Clarkson, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here. You are a Senior Fellow for Religious Liberty at Political Research Associates, which is a progressive think tank that writes about the Christian right and other right-wing movements in Somerville, Massachusetts. Your article, A Distrumpian Vision for LGBTQ People, is in the winter issue of the Public Eye magazine.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
That was Frederick Clarkson. He's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates and most lately the author of the article, A Distrumpian Vision for LGBTQ People. Go to writersvoice.net for a link. Finally, Black History Month has arrived. Let's listen to poet Danez Smith read her poem CREAM. It's a personal meditation about the long impact of slavery down to today.
I am Danez Smith, and this is Cream after Morgan Parker, after Wu-Tang. In the morning, I think about money, green horned lord of my waking, forest in which I stumble toward no salvation, prison made of emerald and pennies. In my wallet, I keep anxiety and a condom. I used to sell my body, but now my blood spoiled. All my favorite songs tell me to get money. I'd rob a bank, but I'm a poet. I'm so broke, I'm a genius. If I was white, I'd take pictures of other pictures and sell them. I come from sharecroppers who come from slaves who do not come from kings. Sometimes I pay the weed man before I pay the light bill. Sometimes it's a synonym for often. I just want a grant or a fellowship or a rich white husband and I'll be straight. I feel most colored when I'm looking at my bank account. I feel most colored when I scream, ball so hard, motherfucker wanna find me. I spent one summer stealing from rag stock. If I went to jail, I'd live rent free, but there is no way to avoid making white people richer. A prison is a plantation made of stone and steel. Being locked up for selling drugs is equal to being locked up for trying to eat. A bald fade costs 20 bones nowadays. What's a blacker tax than blackness? What costs more than being American and poor? Here is where I say reparations. Here is where I say got 20 bucks I can borrow. Student loans are like slavery, but not. But with vacation days, but not. But police, I don't know what it says about me when white institutions give me money. How much is the Powerball this week? I'm gonna print my own money and be my own god and live forever in a green frame. My grandmama is great at saving money. Before my grandfather passed, he showed me where he hid his money and his gun. My aunt can't hold on to a dollar, a job, her brain. I love how easy it is to be bad with money. Don't ask me about my taxes. The B in debt is a silent black boy trapped.
That was poet Danez Smith reading her poem CREAM. You can read it too by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.